history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. There are people who have been through extraordinary things on our behalf, and we'll never know unless we take a little time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey each week, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I am at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum in San Luis Obispo, California. Just a few feet away from us, the red light is on. Their Veterans History Project interview room is live right now. They're recording another veteran story. They've been doing that for years here. One of the veterans in their collection is the gentleman who's joining us today, 94-year-old Al Finley. He is a docent here at the museum. How long you been doing that, Al?
About 5 years now.
What made you decide to come down here every Thursday afternoon and among all these artifacts and photos and mementos, add a little living history to the mix?
Well, I get back in the military service. I've always loved the military. So
you spent a good chunk of your life in the military.
Yes, so 29 years. Yes.
And it was a pretty eventful first year or two during World War II, which we're going to hear about. But before we talk about the Army Air Corps and B-24s and being shot down and being a prisoner of war and getting liberated and all those adventures, what about your childhood? Bartlesville, Oklahoma. What kind of place was that like to grow up?
Bartlesville, Oklahoma was run by Phillips Petroleum Company. I worked for them in Pampa, Texas, and Borger, Texas. I was actually working there when I had a phone call from my dad and said that he had a friend on the draft board, and my name was getting very close to being called. So if I didn't want to go to the Army, et cetera, I better enlist in a branch I'd like to do. So I did.
And you thought maybe you'd become a pilot?
I thought maybe I would become a pilot, yes.
Where did that come from? Had you always been into aviation or fascinated with planes?
I think I was watching the movies all the time. My dad was a projectionist at the movie, so I saw all the movies free. So.
Wow, that's every kid's dream right there.
Yeah, it was that dad, yeah.
Well, but I wonder, because I've talked to so many veterans who were in Oklahoma during those years, who a lot of them got chased out by the Dust Bowl.
Yes.
In the Depression years, were people still going to the movies? Did
oh,
your
yes.
dad still have a job?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
We had three movies in Bartlesville.
Three different theaters?
It's all stayed open, yeah. All owned by the same company.
Uh-huh. So you and your brother got to go in for free all the time?
All the time, and my sister, three of us.
Does that mean free popcorn, too?
No. You had to pay 5 cents for that.
Which is probably a pretty hefty price in those days.
Yeah.
All right. So I that gives me a little taste of your childhood. But when your dad says, hey, they're going to draft you, you better pick something you want to do. What was it about flying that you thought sounded attractive?
That's a good question. I really don't know why. It just seemed like the Air Force was pilots, you know, so I wanted to try that.
And I guess the other thing I should ask you, before that, before there's even a thought of you getting drafted, I bet you remember something about December 7th, 1941.
I do remember that, yes. It was on a Sunday morning. I was sleeping late, and my mother woke me up and said that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. And I said, where's Pearl Harbor? I had no idea where it was. But she said it was in Hawaii. So.
Was that kind of hard to wrap your brain around?
At my age, I think so. I think so. It was just, I didn't understand it very clearly.
And I guess you would have been, what, 18 at the time, huh?
I was born in 23, so that's right, 18, yes, yes.
So maybe you had just graduated high school?
Graduated in May, yes.
In May of 41?
May of 41, yes.
So how long was it till it hit you, hey, maybe I will be drafted at some point, or maybe my brother and I might end up involved in this thing?
I tell you the truth, it never occurred to me, you know. I don't know why, but I enlisted in October of 42, and I was called to active duty in January of 43, so that started it all.
And so when you go in, like you said, you're thinking, hey, I'm going to get to be a pilot. What was it that changed that course?
A physical. When I had a physical, and they said I would see double at high altitude. They make a radio operator and a gunner out of me, but I never saw two fighters.
Well, yeah, and you got plenty of opportunities to demonstrate what your vision would be like at high altitude. Yeah. But when they said that, when they washed you out of pilot training because of your eyesight, was that a disappointment?
Yes, it was a disappointment, yes. Yeah. They'd sent me to college in Southwestern Texas, Teachers College, and I'd gone there for 3 months. We even had 10 hours in a little Ronica aircraft there. So then when I went to San Antonio and they gave me the air physical and I washed out of my eyesight, I was very disappointed. Yeah, very disappointed.
But you'd gotten that little taste of being in the cockpit.
Yes, that's right.
And when they say radio operator and gunner, that means a different kind of training that you'd have to go through.
Yes.
Did you take to it or was it challenging?
It was pretty challenging. I went to my radio school in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I was there about 5 months, and then I went to Yuma, Arizona for my gunnery. Actually, the radio, learning the DITA, the Morse code, I can still take that and send that to this day. It's something you never forget, you know?
Really? So if a Morse code signal interrupted our broadcast right now, you'd be able to interpret it.
I could probably tell you what it was, yeah, if it wasn't too fast.
Sure. So you're training to do that, and they end up putting you on bombers. B-24s exclusively? Did you ever get in a B-17?
Or no? I was in a B-17, yes, in later years for a short period of time. But most of my time were other aircraft, really.
Well, in your 29 years, sure.
Yeah. I had 18 years on flying status, so I was on flying status more than I wasn't on. So.
Yeah, so, and we can get to that, some of the other planes that you would fly later. But as a very young man still, here in 1944, I mean, you're turning 21 in April of that year. A couple months after that, there's storm in Normandy. And then a couple months after that, you're heading across the Atlantic to go be part of this war. Were you apprehensive at all about what you're getting into?
No, really not. I guess I was too young to realize it, you know, but it was just something that everybody else was doing, so I was going to try to do my part.
And did you go overseas with the same crew that you had trained with?
Yes. Actually, we flew the northern route. We picked up new airplanes in Hamilton Field near San Francisco.
Right.
And we were told there, when you see your airplane, if they have a lower ball turret, you'll go to the Pacific. And if they don't have, you're going to go to ETO, European Theater, because they'd done away with the lower ball turret because the German Luftwaffe was almost non-existent at that time. And the pull and the slowing of the aircraft caused by the turret, it was not worth it to use it anymore.
And you got one of the ones without a bottom ball turret.
That's right. Everybody clapped their hands. I lost my job, though, because I was going to be a waist gunner.
Uh-huh.
But with not having the Sperry lower ball turret anymore, the ball turret, he took my place at the gunner, so I never fired a gun in combat. I just the radio hopper.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm sure over time and some of the missions that you ended up on, maybe that turned out to be a good thing.
Probably so.
But how well did you get to know those guys?
A family. You get a crew like crew of 10, just a family, you know. There's not too much officer and enlisted man. You're just a combined family that everybody has to do their job to get the job done, you know, really.
So how would you explain what your job was going to be when you flew your first mission?
Well, my first mission was on the 5th of September, 1944, and the target was Karlsruhe, Germany, which was on the French border. Like I say, it's supposed to have been a milk run just to break us in, but it broke us the other way. One of my jobs was to watched the Bombay doors, and the Bombay doors operated like this, slid or so. A B-17 opened up this way, and the B-24 did this way.
Retracted, as opposed to flaring out. Yeah.
But if they creeped too far closed, you couldn't release the bombs. So one of my jobs was to watch that. And if it did go to that position, then I had to go out there manually, open it up again.
Uh-huh.
So this first flight, I was very conscientious of all that and looking out the Bombay. And I see a lot of silver things floating in the air. And I thought, that's flak. I never thought flak was pretty, you know. And it wasn't much longer than I saw real flak. The burst of the flak and it's there. And we got hit after our bomb run. So
much for a milk run.
So much for a milk run. And so much for the number one mission of 35. I couldn't see 35 after that happened.
So what did it feel like when the flak hit the airplane?
Well, it bounced the airplane. It just jolted the airplane. So you knew something was wrong. Something's happened.
And tell us what happened next, because there are missions where you get hit by flak and you make it back to your base, and there are others where you can't do that. So
well,
what happened this time?
It so happened that we couldn't get back. Our damage, I think, a lot was gasoline, that we'd lost gasoline. They'd hit the tanks. We got back into France near Epernay, and the pilot made a crash landing with both wheels up. But before he made the crash landing, on a B-24, you have a blister up where the navigator, bombardier, can get up and look back to see the pilot. Well, the navigator got up in there and pointed down. And the pilot thought he meant, are we going down? And he was asking him, do we want us to bail out? And the pilot shook his head and he and the nose gunner bailed out of the airplane before we crash landed.
Talk about miscommunication. Wow.
But both of them were safe. Everybody was safe. Nobody got a scratch in it. So it was a beautiful landing.
But this is your very first mission.
Yes.
You're a 21-year-old kid. You've never done this before. And your plane gets shot up, and you're landing somewhere that you weren't planning to land. I mean, is that scary? Is it nerve-wracking?
I don't think it was, really. At that time, I don't think we really knew it well enough, you know. But being shot down on your first mission and supposed to do 35, you could see it was kind of gloomy future, you know.
Yeah. I guess you have to have a lot of trust in your pilot in that scenario, too.
Oh, yes. We had a wonderful. He was from Oklahoma, too. Ponca City.
Uh-huh. So how did that landing feel from where you were on the plane?
Well, I'd gone to the back, and it was a very smooth landing. He tore up the Bombay and maybe bent a prop on one or two engines, but just slid to a stop. It was really, really good. Radio still worked. APU still worked. We had a home for a week before we went back to England.
Well, and here's the other question that I'm sure some people are asking. You said you can't get back to England. You have to land in France. At that point, there are parts of France that are in American and Allied control. There are also parts of France that are still in the enemy's hands.
Yes, yeah.
Did you guys know whether or not this spot where you were landing was hostile territory or not?
Not at the time, no, no.
So you don't know if you're going to get captured when you land?
Oh, no.
But you weren't scared?
Not long enough. We'd no longer come to a stop. Then some GIs drove up in a Jeep, wanted to know if we wanted to go snipe hunting. We said, what? They said there were German snipers still in there. They had been liberated about 2 weeks. And there were still German snipers, and they were going out. And we said, no, we'll stay with the airplane.
Wow. That must have been a relief, though, to see those uniforms in that Jeep.
Oh, yeah. We stayed there about 6 days.
What'd you do all that time?
Well, the French brought us bread and grapes and wine and invited us to their home for supper. And we kind of had a party while we were there. And then I think on a Saturday morning, a B-24 flew over and happened to be our commanding officer. And he dropped a little message for us that told us to get back to England and go to Lille. The GIs took us to Lille in a Jeep. And then we caught a C-47 from Lille, flew back to England.
So he was basically saying, you've had enough time off now, even though your plane can't fly. Find a way to get back over here. We need you.
That's right, about right. Yeah. But then when we got back, Our group had been taken, actually the whole wing had been taken off of combat because they started flying gasoline to Patton and to General Montgomery. Patton was, we went to Nancy and unloaded there. It took them about an hour and a half. They unloaded it with electrical pumps or hydraulic pumps. And when we took it to Montgomery and Lil, we had to stay there all night because they took it out in 5 gallon jerry cans.
Wow, that's a long process.
It was a long process.
You know, I've got one more question came to mind while you were there after your crash landing. Did you guys give those two guys who bailed out a hard time about that?
No. We're so glad to see them, really, because we don't want it to happen to them.
And a lot of people probably haven't heard this aspect that you're sharing now. So when you get back to your squadron, the 786th, part of the 466th Bomb Group, they say, okay, we're going to be flying, but it's not bombing missions. We need these bombers to transport fuel because the troops on the ground can't advance unless they have it. How did you feel, though, about being on a plane that was loaded down with all that fuel?
Really not much difference. You carry much gasoline on a mission for 8 hours, you know. But the only thing, it was kind of upsetting because it took the pilot, the co-pilot, the navigator, and the engineer, and the radio operator, and the gunners they left home because they didn't need them.
Now, why wouldn't you need the gunners? I mean, if they're fighters, you could still use them.
We were not going to be flying over enemy territory to get to Nancy or get to Lil, really.
But, I mean, there are lots of stories of intruder airplanes that would fly into those areas at times, too. I guess you guys could have been vulnerable.
Yes, there were several incidents where you come home from a mission, you know, you're smoking a cigarette and letting down, and they would get attacked by the German Luftwaffe that was waiting for you over there.
They'd follow you home and then come in to England.
That's right.
Sure.
It never happened to us, but it did happen to some of them.
So you flew quite a few missions like that where you guys are just transporting fuel?
Yes. We flew from maybe the 10th or 12th of September until into October because Patton was moving so fast he was running out of gasoline.
Once Al and his crew returned to bombing missions, anti-aircraft fire again became an issue. And on February 6, 1945, that flak brought tragic consequences. When we come back, how Al Finley survived when his plane was shot down, what he endured as a prisoner of war, how a letter from a stranger reopened this chapter of history for him decades later, and how this 94-year-old has honored the four members of his crew who did not survive that final mission. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 94-year-old Al Finley. He grew up in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, but now you'll find this 29-year veteran of the Air Force every Thursday afternoon at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum in San Luis Obispo, California, where listeners have been hearing Hometown Heroes for years on our affiliate KVEC. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos of Al and see the special way he's honored his fallen crewmates there at the museum. He had enlisted in the Army Air Corps with the dream of becoming a pilot. Instead, he ended up as a radio radio man on B-24s with the 466th Bomb Group flying out of Attlebridge, England. We heard Al explain how his very first mission, which was supposed to be a milk run, an easy one with little opposition, ended in a crash landing in France. That did not leave him optimistic about reaching his mission quota.
Yeah, I think when it first started, it was 25, and then it went to 30, and then it went to 35. When we went over, it was 35 missions. Yeah.
You didn't quite make it there, did you?
No, we didn't quite get there. We had another crew that we'd flown with in the States. Real good friends. And we had the same amount of missions. So after, I forget the number of missions, it was, I think, 25. They sent you to the recreation, a hotel or something on the coast, you know, for a week of relaxation.
Right.
Well, being that both of us had got 25 missions, the pilots flipped a coin to see which one would go, and my pilot lost, and so we were shot down the next mission. We never got to go to R&R.
So a coin flip decided your destiny.
That's right. It decided my destination.
And I want to hear about that 26th and final mission that you flew in World War II. But I don't want to miss anything in between. We talked about how rocky your first mission was. Was there anything between mission 1 and 26 that stands out that was noteworthy or memorable?
Not so much. It's all, I don't recall anything dangerous that happened. We did land in Paris one time and stay all night. It had been a long mission, and we had to refuel before we could get back to England. But it was all pretty old standard missions.
Well, I can understand how the 26th mission and everything that followed would dwarf the rest of the memories you have from that time, because this was pretty insane.
Well, on the 26th mission, we'd been to the target had been Magdeburg. And we'd been to the target and bombed Magdeburg, and we were on a return trip. We were flying over the Ruhr Valley. We flew through a flak shield. I don't think it was there all the time. I think it must have just started about the time we got there.
Ooh.
Anyway, we got hit at number one engine and set it on fire. We were hit in the rear part of the aircraft. So I got out of my position, wasn't far to between the pilot and co-pilot. I think our interphone was out the same way, the reason I did that. The engineer got out of it. He flew the Upper Martin turret, and he got out of the turret, and we were both standing by the pilot and the co-pilot, and the pilot said, "Bill, the engineer, go back to the rear and check the controls back there." He said, I can't control the airplane."
So maybe the cables to the rudder had been severed or damaged?
Yes.
Okay.
So Bill went back to the bomb bay and went back to the rear and gone a very short time, and he came back and said that the controls were cut. And also all three gunners had been wounded and they were in bad condition. And then he said, "I'm going to go back and take them." And I said, "Work over them, you know." And I said, "I'll go back with you too." And as I turned to go, the pilot grabbed my arm and said, "I'll start throwing everything over out of the bomb bay that you can. The flak suits, the flak helmets, even if you get your radios loose. But I can't hold the altitude." So I started doing that. And first thing I know, I look back up and the co-pilot was standing up, getting his parachute. And he said, "Bail out, bail out." So I grabbed my chute. And it was a chest chute, and hooked it on my chute. I took my GI boots that was beside me, and as I went out, I put them on the catwalk. Then I bailed out, and I left my shoes on the catwalk. But anyway, I was so low that we were so low that I saw two sheets come out after I went. I didn't see the airplane crash. I saw the airplane kind of climb and fall off, but I never did see it crash, because when I hit the ground, I hit it so hard it knocked me out, and I was unconscious for I don't know how long, laying there. And when I woke up, there were three German, I assume they were farmers, standing over me. Two of them had pitchforks, and the other one had a gun. Again, I was so kind of woozy, I didn't really know what was going on, you know. The one with the gun pointed at my head, you know, and I thought, "I bought the farm," you know. And then he turned the gun away and fired it, and then started laughing. And then I must have passed out again, because the next thing I knew, I was in a farmhouse. One of them was there, and a woman was there, and somebody had taken my wristwatch and my dog tags. They'd gone through my clothes, you know. I tried to ask how I got there, and they showed me a wheelbarrow. They'd put me in a wheelbarrow and rolled me in a wheelbarrow to where it was. It was after dark when somebody came back with the police and took us to the local jail. I say us, it took me to the local jail, but the others were in the jail. There were the co-pilot and the navigator and the nose gunner. The pilot wasn't there because they didn't see his chute open, and he was loose in the country for about 2 weeks before he turned himself in. But there was the nose gunner and myself, the co-pilot, and the navigator.
So that's four of you there at that jail.
There was five of them. Well, yeah, four of us, that's right, because the pilot wasn't there. Okay, I'm trying to get five out of it.
Well, and the math, so everybody listening understands, you had nine men on the plane.
The Bombardier wasn't flying then because what they had done was take the nose gunner, and as the lead aircraft would drop their bombs, he would toggle the bomb. So we lost the Bombardier, really.
So you've got a nine-man crew.
Yes.
And you talked about the three gunners in the back being wounded.
Yes.
They all went down with the plane?
They all went down with the plane, plus the engineer went down with the plane, and there was nothing wrong. He got caught back there.
He was back trying to help them.
That's right.
And it cost him his
life. So nobody knows how bad they were injured or what was going on in the rear of the aircraft, but Bill, the engineer, and he went down.
Did you guys know that at the time? That they had not survived?
Well, we'd known that they'd gone. We didn't know that, but assumed the airplane crashed. We didn't know they'd be killed. We didn't know that till the Germans told us.
You mentioned how hard you hit the ground because you had to bail out at such low altitude.
Yes, yes.
You hit it so hard it knocked you unconscious. Did you have injuries as a result of that?
Just my back, the lower part of my back. It was hard. It was hard for me to sit down, so I hurt the lower part, tailbone or something.
But when you find yourself at this jail and you see some familiar faces, yes, that had to mean a lot to you to see them.
That's right, yes. My navigator, Rock Kramer, could understand a little German, but he didn't let them know that he understood German, you know. But anyway, he told us, he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg. He said, one of these fellows has got a mother or something that lives in where we just bombed, you know. Ooh. So he said, don't say anything about Magdeburg.
Yeah, and you can laugh about it now, yeah, but at the time, right. I'm sure there was a real fear that these people could kill you.
Yes, there was a real fear, yes. We spent one night in the jail, the local jail, and then the next afternoon, an officer, I think a lieutenant in the Luftwaffe, and a sergeant came to pick us up. He had a machine gun that he carried. They put us on a passenger train, and we went to Essen, which was a town in the Ruhr Valley. About the time we got there, the British were starting with bombing. So they took us off the train and took us down to the underground. A lot of civilians were there at that time, and they didn't care much for us. And they kind of started walking towards us, you know. The officer said something to the sergeant, and he pulled up his machine gun, and they backed away. But so it was just that way until the bombing was over, and then we went up, got back on the train, and it's very kind of vague now. I don't know, it took a day or 2 days to get to Oberursel, which is the interrogation center. I was in solitary confinement for 11 days, and the navigator was in solitary confinement for 13 days, and the other... Let's see, Smitty was a nose gunner, and they let him go early. The pilot wasn't there yet. He was still running around loose in the country. But I was there for 11 days, and then they put me on a boxcar on the train.
Before we hear about that,
okay,
11 days there in solitary with not a lot to eat or drink, probably not even that much room to stretch out in, I would imagine, huh?
I had a bucket for a toilet, and I had a straw mattress. Not much more in there, no.
And what about the actual interrogation. What kinds of things did they try to get out of you?
Well, it wasn't not what I thought, though. They wanted to know about the V-2 bombs, what the English were thinking of, you know, how much of a damage it's causing in England, actual damage, and then, you know, if it's the people are scared and stuff like that. But as far as military, I had very few questions about that because he knew more about my outfit than I did.
I've heard a lot of guys say that.
Yeah, he knew more my commanding officer's name, et cetera, et cetera. But they'd got it from previous people, I guess, you know. But most of my interrogation was not sensible questions, you know. They were just like they about the British, et cetera, et cetera. And do you think the war is going to be over soon, you know? My interrogator was a Captain Rubel.
And how was his English?
Good. Very excellent English, yes, yeah.
A lot of those interrogators they had spent a lot of time in the States.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, and you said they asked you, when do you think the war is going to be over? Again, I'm thinking about you. This is February 1945. You don't know that the war is going to be over in 3 months.
No, I don't know.
I mean, I imagine the future had to be a real uncertain thing for you at that point.
It would have to be, yeah.
And how did you handle that? How did you deal with that reality that, hey, I may never get out of captivity or I may die in captivity?
I don't think that ever involved I never thought of that, you know, because looking back, when we were hauling gasoline to Pat, they were moving so fast against the Germans. They're running, you know, in other words, their supplies couldn't keep up with them. So it wouldn't be too long, you know. We were told that not to try to escape because the war is going to be over pretty soon. So they took away our guns so we couldn't get in trouble. That just implied that, well, you know, it's not going to be long now.
That said, there was plenty of trouble for you in the months that followed and even in the days. So you mentioned 11 days there at the interrogation center, and then they put you on another one of these 40-8s, packed in with a bunch of other POWs.
Yes.
How tightly were you packed?
You couldn't sit down. You had to stand. It wasn't too far to Wetzlar. Like I say, it was a transit camp because I'd been in my flying clothes for all this time, 11 or 12 days. I hadn't shaved. I hadn't showered. I was still wearing my flying boots. And so at Wetzlar, we got a shower, shave, and change of clothes. I think maybe the Red Cross had something to do with it, you know. But I got boots and et cetera, and was there about, I guess I was there about 3 days. And then they put us back on the boxcars, again, crammed in like sardines. And we hadn't gone too far that day, and we got attacked by our own fighters, and they strafed we were just crammed in there. And
so everyone understands, you're on this boxcar, and you know from a lot of your missions, a lot of the targets are railroads and marshalling logs.
Oh, yes.
And they're trying to take out the supplies before they get to the front line. They don't know what's in these boxcars.
That's right.
So your own American planes are shooting the boxcar that you're in.
That's right.
And you saw people get hit.
Yes. I there were several casualties, yeah. And the Germans finally opened the doors and let us out. And there was a forest right clumped of trees close to the track. And we were running for that. And the fighters saw that, I guess, and they stopped firing because they assumed it was either a troop train or carrying supplies or something, you know. It wasn't marked or anything. So they were probably shooting anything that moved in at that time.
Yeah. Boy, I can't imagine how scary that must be, how helpless a feeling that is.
You are helpless, yeah. You can't fight back. You can't do anything but run.
But you survived that.
Went to Nuremberg, and Nuremberg was just packed with prisoners. Just terrible. Had lice, bed bugs, roaches, all that stuff.
And what'd you have to eat?
Very, very, very little. Very little. I have a piece of German bread that tastes like sawdust. A soup invariably had little dead insects in it. That was about our food. Every once in a while, we would get some Red Cross parcels, but they'd puncture all the cans, so you had to eat them right away or let them spoil, you know. So they were pretty tricky on that. Nuremberg was another place that the British loved to bomb the Nuremberg, and our camp was very close to the town, and we would just bounce on them when they started bombing.
And what did your family know, if anything, about what had happened to you?
I don't think they knew anything, nothing.
Had you been reported missing? Did they get a telegram or anything?
Well, I didn't know at the time.
Right.
But later, they were told I was missing, and then when it was POW, they knew that I was a prisoner of war, yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine being in your shoes and how lonely and desperate and seemingly hopeless that scenario could be. I mean, you're on the other side of the world from your family. You've lost your freedom. You're not getting anything to eat. What was it that kept you going or kept your hope burning?
Well, a few prayers now and then I think didn't hurt, you know. You had somebody upstairs that was looking after you. So I felt pretty confident with that, you know. I'd always been somebody that I loved to go out fishing and camping and you know, live on my own, etc., like that. So I think a lot of that held over where I was, you know.
And how much did you weigh before you got shot down?
Oh, before I got shot, I must have weighed 170, 75.
Well, and we'll get to your liberation and find out how much you weighed then, but your liberation didn't come there at the camp at Nuremberg. They had to move you because the lines were getting too close?
That's right, yes. It's supposed to be, if you get within 50 miles, they're supposed to move you because you're not supposed to be in the combat zones.
In fact, the prisoners he joined in the Nuremberg area had actually been moved there from Poland for that same reason. When we come back, we'll hear about the dangers posed by a march from one prison camp to another, the eventual joy of liberation, and the mental and emotional weight of the whole ordeal that lingered long after World War II. Don't forget to check out the photos and video of Al at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and one of those stories that reminds us of just how fortunate we are, of just how much we can take for granted, and of how great a debt we owe to our veterans. For decades after World War II, as the Air Force took him around the world, as he and his wife moved to England, bought an old pub, and turned it into an antique shop, even his closest friends had no idea what Al Findlay had been through as a prisoner of war. Shot down on his 26th mission, captured, interrogated, protected from an angry mob of civilians by German guards, shot at by American and British planes as he was being transported. We've heard a lot of that, but the most compelling elements of Al's story are still to come. A paltry diet of insect-laden soup and bread made with tree flour, a POW's euphemism for sawdust, had weakened the 21-year-old as he and other prisoners set out on what would be a 100-mile march from the Nuremberg area to Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany.
We started on the march on leaving Nuremberg on the 4th of April. In the afternoon, we hadn't gone too long, maybe 2 hours or something, and we were under a train trestle, and we got hit with three more American fighters. The first one strafed, and the second one started strafing and then stopped, and then the third one peeled off and didn't strike, so they must have recognized that we were POWs or something. Then after that, we had toilet paper, and we made a big sign out in a field, POW, you know. So, in other words, one plane saw that because From then on, there was one plane that flew every day, would come and check on us, where we were, etc. I'm glad they knew we were there and who we were.
I guess so, because otherwise there's nothing solid to hold on to. I mean, you don't know where you're going. You don't know how long it's going to take.
That's right.
You hadn't had much to eat. I have to think this was exhausting to be marching every day.
Yeah, and the weather was bad. It was raining, and it was really a bad trip. It took us about almost 2 weeks. I think we got to Moosburg in about somewhere around the 20th of April, I think. A week before we were liberated.
Well, I'm trying to remember when your birthday is. Isn't it in April?
Yeah, it's 14th of April. I spent it on the march.
So your 22nd birthday, you're marching from one prison camp to another.
Yes.
I imagine you don't forget that birthday.
No.
Did you even know what day it was?
Oh, I knew it was 14th. I think President Roosevelt had died on the 12th of April.
Yep.
So that was saddening news we got, you know. And I don't think we got it until on my birthday, you know. I remember there was four or five of us. We sat down in a field, you know, and I said, well, this is my birthday. So they sang happy birthday to me. But, you know, on the march, there was several times you're walking along, you know. And old German ladies would come out with a sack, and they'd have, like, potato, and hand us a potato, you know. And, it's just heartwarming to think that they would do that, you know, after all the bombing and stuff that we had done.
Yeah, that shows some real compassion.
That's right.
And, you know, you mentioned saying a lot of prayers and feeling that somebody was looking out for you. But as the days and weeks went by, were there days where you wondered and you thought, am I going to make it to tomorrow? How's this going to end up?
No, I don't think so. I think, in other words, once we left Nuremberg, we know we left because Patton was so close that they had to move it.
Yeah.
And once we got to Moosburg, I don't think there was any further place to go. So, like I say, on the 29th of April, they came in. We knew something was happening that morning. I'm quite sure. I think it seemed like it was on a Sunday, but it was the 29th of April. You got up, and everything was so quiet, and the guards were gone, so we knew something had happened. And a couple of planes flew over and wiggled their, you know, and it wasn't long until the GIs came in.
Well, and it wasn't just the GIs. I mean, this is the one camp that General Patton himself showed up to liberate.
Patton came in to Moosburg about 2 days after they liberated us. Uh-huh. I know he was on a jeep or a half track or something, standing up, and his shiny helmet and his pearl-handled pistols.
You're there in this huge crowd of POWs.
Oh, yeah.
And you see this famous general who you've all known about and heard about standing up there with, as you described it. What did that feel like?
It was wonderful. It really was, yeah. You had a little faith in our government, in our military then, you know. But, it was really a sight.
Did he say anything? Did he give a little speech or anything? Or?
No. Just came through and just waved saluting, you know.
So you said when you took off for that last mission, you probably weighed around 170.
That's right, yeah.
So what about when you got liberated?
I was about 135.
So in 3 months, you lost 20% of your body weight.
I guess so, yes.
So what about from there? When you've had to live for 3 months without freedom and you don't know when you're going to get it again, what does it feel like to realize, hey, I'm not a prisoner anymore. I'm a free man again.
It was hard to realize, really. They kept us there after we were liberated for about a week. But they brought in the food, and the white bread tastes like angel food cake, you know. And in some ways, they gave us too much food, you know. There was a lot of sickness, eating too much. But they flew a bunch of us to Camp Lucky Strike, which was on the French coast. And I was at Lucky Strike for, I would think, 2 to 3 weeks. They gave us eggnog every day and food and stuff and debriefed us and all this stuff. So.
And I've seen a photograph of your POW mugshot that the Germans took. Is that where you got that? Or where did you come across that? Did you get it when they liberated the camp, or did you get it at Lucky Strike?
You mean my POW?
The one the Germans took.
Well, I didn't have that until 2008.
Oh, really?
A gentleman was looking for his people who was in POW back in Maryland, and he found a whole box of about 175 pictures, and they were all prisoner of war, and mine was in one of them. So it had my serial number on it. So through that, they traced it to where I was living in Hammett, California.
So more than 60 years later, this comes out of the blue.
2008.
Most of the guys that he found in that file were probably gone. You were probably one of the few that was still living.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible. That had to make your day.
Oh, it did. I didn't recognize the picture at first, you know. I never talked too much about my wife of 52 years. She never asked me any about it, and I never volunteered any for it. She knew I was a prisoner of war, but that was it. Mm. I never discussed it with her, et cetera, you know. It was always a private part of my life and a sad part of my life, but I had to live it anyway.
And after they nurse you back to health there in La Havre at Camp Lucky Strike, they get you back here to the States. A lot of guys have talked about sailing into New York Harbor, going past the Statue of Liberty. Did you have that experience or not?
Yes, I saw the statue. That was wonderful, yeah.
I mean, it just seems like there might be a little more significance to that statue for someone who had been through what you had been through.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. It really warms your heart to see that, you know.
What about seeing your family again?
Oh, I was happy to see my family, yeah. I met my dad walking down the street.
You didn't know he was going to be there?
He didn't know I was going to be there. And I didn't know he was going to be there. So that was quite an exciting time, yeah.
Wow. A picture of that would be something. Yeah, see the look on your guys' faces.
Would have been.
You mentioned that this was a difficult part of your life. And from what I understand, maybe one of the most difficult circumstances was after you got discharged, you went to college at the University of Oklahoma for a couple semesters.
Yes.
And the reason you had to leave was you were having nightmares, flashbacks.
Yes.
How did that manifest?
It was very often. I was back in the airplane. My roommate said he couldn't sleep with all the racket that I was making, you know. So that was one reason I quit school again. I couldn't cut the mustard with a bunch of young kids anymore, you know.
Well, and I mean, this sounds like a real, I don't know if debilitating is the word, but a real difficult reality to live with, because you can't control when these things are coming on.
Well, you know, in other words, at that time they called it battle fatigue,
yeah.
And now they call it PTSD. That went for a long time. I was back in that airplane for many, many, many times.
Does that ever happen anymore?
Very seldom. Maybe once in a blue moon, every 3 months or something, well, I will have that. I've felt kind of guilty all my life now since that I came so close. If it hadn't been for the pilot, I wouldn't be here. I came so close to going back there with Bill. I say it was a step away from death, you know.
So when Bill went back to help the wounded gunners, you were going to go with him, but the pilot said you need to start jettisoning stuff and making this plane lighter.
That's right, that's right.
But if he hadn't said that, you would have gone.
I would have gone. I'd taken one step to go when he grabbed my hat. So I was that close to death.
And you would have gone down with the plane.
Sure, yeah. Everything happened so fast, you know. You didn't have really time to think, you know. Bill's, he's gone back. Nobody knows how the three in the rear were you other than he. He went back the first to check the cables, and he found them wounded. And then he came forward and told us, and then we went back right back again. And he was the only one on the crew that was married and had a child.
So when you say you felt guilty, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I think I hear you saying is that sometimes you wish you would have gone back and Bill would have survived.
So, yes.
And do you know, were their bodies ever found?
Yes, they were buried. I've got some German papers and stuff that they sent me when it was all declassified. The Air Force sent it to me, and it covers a lot of the period I was over there, and it did say where the men were buried. You know, when the pilot came in to camp and we saw him again, he didn't really know that all of them had been killed, you know, and so that broke him up too, you know. And he said that he was going to put Bill in for a medal when he got back to the States, because he should have got the Medal of Honor, really, back there tending to them, and gave his life doing that, you know.
Yeah.
I've never known where he got a medal or not, you know.
And as far as your story, you had turned down a chance to stay in the Air Corps and get a higher rank. You go to college. You told us these flashbacks, this PTSD 70-plus years ago, changes that course. So you re-enlist. You end up putting a total of 29 years in the Air Force. And I'm looking at your hat here. It says World War II veteran hat. I see the Caterpillar. That's because you jumped out of the airplane, right?
That's right.
But I see a whole bunch of other aircraft that came along later on. You flew in a lot of different planes, didn't you?
Yes.
I see. Is that a B-29 there?
Yes, that's the B-29. Yeah. I was in 22nd Bomb Group. They were in Okinawa, actually, ended up at Marsh Field.
Is that a C-121 Constellation there?
I was in a Connie at McClellan, and I was in a KC-135 at Offutt. I flew there from 62 to 67.
I see a C-47 on there. You've got a lot of planes.
C-47, I was in Manila in 50 to 52 at C-47s. I was in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil for 3.5 years with Air Attaché's office in C-47.
And that's where you became a father.
That's where I became a father. That's right. I adopted a Brazilian boy there, about a year and a half old.
What made your wife, you and your wife, decide to adopt a young man there in Brazil?
She had one miscarriage and couldn't have children, so we adopted the boy. He's now living in England, married over there, so he comes and sees me about every 2 years.
29 years in the Air Force, and really, you saw most of the world that way.
Well, it was,
right?
Isn't it? Yeah.
The Pacific, Asia, Europe, South America.
I've had a wonderful life in the service, yeah. Very, 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 very fortunate.
And when you say you felt guilty about Bill, I'm wondering if you talk about the wonderful life you've had. Have you had a sense of trying to make the most of your life in light of what happened to Bill and those other three?
I think so. Like I say, I've had a guilty feeling ever since that happened. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I just couldn't get rid of it, you know. And I think when I got those plaques, I had a plaque put up on the wall about 2 years ago.
And we're talking right here where we're sitting at the Central Coast Veterans Memorial Museum. So there's a wall near the entrance with all these plaques that list the names of different servicemen. So you had your name put up there.
I had my name put up and my service up, yes.
So that'll be here long after you're gone.
That's right, that's right.
But then you had another idea.
Yes, I did. I decided that to get plaques for each one of those and have them positioned where each one touched my plaque, and that we would be back together again after 70-some years. And that's happened, and I think big relief has been taken off of my shoulders for doing that.
That's not free. That costs some money to do that.
That's beside the point.
Well, that is my point.
Okay.
Because what you got from doing that, from honoring those guys from your crew who aren't here anymore, sounds like that satisfaction and that maybe closure that you developed from that is priceless.
I do feel that way, yes.
I'm sure there's tons of other stories we haven't had time to get into. But I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us this story. I'm pretty sure that Bill and those other three fallen brothers of yours would be really proud of what you're doing.
I hope so.
Do you ever get a chance to tell that story, to talk about them when you're here as a docent at the museum?
No. It's something that's kind of private, you know. Until 2008, when I got the letter in the POW picture. And that seemed to open everything. I made copies of the POW picture and sent them to all my friends. And most of them didn't know I was a POW. my commanding officer, when I was in Brazil, I sent one of them to him. And he came back to me and says, a tidbit? He says, Al, you never told us you were a prisoner of war. But it was just, you know, it was private.
You know, the fact that you come here every Thursday afternoon and volunteer your time at the Veterans Museum tells me that you care about passing stories on, passing history on, helping future generations understand what your generation did and others.
Yeah.
Specifically from a prisoner of war perspective, what did that experience teach you about our country, about the value of freedom that you think people who come here to the museum should understand?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I don't know. Brokaw said it was the greatest generation. And I guess it was the greatest generation. But all the people that went to war, all people that supported the war, I have pictures of the where they built the B-24s, you know, and just lines and lines and lines of people there working to support the military, you know. So I think it was its greatest generation, you know. I hope we never have to go through anything like that again.
And if we do, we can look to the example you guys set. Is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
I'm thankful that I'm an American. The way of life, I've been to so many foreign countries now since after the war and have seen different kinds of life. Nothing comes up to our standards, so I'm proud and love to be American.
I've got to ask you one more question.
Okay.
And if there's anything I left out, feel free to jump in. I bet you've been asked this before. You're 94 years young.
That's right.
How long are you going to keep coming here every Thursday afternoon at the Veterans Museum to volunteer?
As long as I can. As long as the good Lord allows me to. I've got one bad leg. I don't know how much longer it's going to last. But as long as I can walk, I'll be here.
And what do you get out of it? Where does the satisfaction come from for you?
There's so many people that know nothing about what happened, really, especially the young children, the younger people, you know. You just have to remind them, you know, because it was such an important part of our lives. Even though they didn't partake in it, they're realizing the results of all that effort, you know. So it's just American way of life. Nothing like it.
And can't you tell that Al means that with every fiber of his 94-year-old body? If you find yourself on the Central California coast, I sure hope you'll go pay him a visit at the Veterans Museum there in San Luis Obispo. He's there every Thursday afternoon, and he can show you those plaques honoring the four men who went down with his plane. I also have photos of that for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I have a little postscript for you, too. I'm sure the feelings that Al has for Bill Fowler, that engineer who died trying to help the wounded gunners in the rear of the aircraft, left a powerful impression on you as they did on me. And with a little follow-up research, we've learned that while Bill was posthumously awarded the Purple Heart, he was not decorated for those selfless heroics that ultimately cost him his life. We're going to try our best to get that remedied, and we'll update you if and when that happens. And perhaps Al will have even more to share, because just a couple of days ago, 72 years after that tragic mission, he spoke for the first time with a member of Bill Fowler's family, a nephew who now knows much more about the uncle he never met, from someone who witnessed Bill's courage, his compassion, his heroism firsthand in the skies over Germany. So we can look forward to hopefully another chapter in this story, but we're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time of what Al Finley's prisoner of war story illustrates in powerful fashion. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org.
Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.